Okay, we can begin now. And I did promise for this evening's talk to discuss the other types of meditation other than the breath meditation, Anapanasati, and also metta meditation. I should say that there is one meditation which is very close to Anapanasati, which I certainly don't recommend. And I mentioned that to somebody in the interviews. That's called Anapanasati. So Anapanasati, Ana means along with, part of the breath, Sati, mindfulness. So Anapanasati is mindfulness along with the pain. Remember that, Anapanasati. So 6 years the Buddha did Anapanasati and got nowhere. So he let that go. And he did Anapana with the middle way, a very peaceful, comfortable, but very strong way. So be able to find out that degree of comfort in the body where you're not indulging, but you're also not experiencing pain, that middle way. But the main object of meditation I wanted to talk about, because quite a few, especially of the monks, have mentioned it, is asupa. This is the meditation on the loathsomeness of the body. This is very much a monastic type of meditation, but you know, the upasakas, upasikas, they want to keep up with the monks and the nuns. They also want to become so ones and arahats. So they also want to try and do whatever the monks do. But if you're living the lay life and do a super meditation, you find it very difficult when you look at your wife and think that she's a mess of unwholesome, ugly things, you make her very upset. So it's very difficult for the lay community to do a super meditation. Maybe as you get older in life, maybe just when you've brought up your family, then you can do a super meditation. And it's actually quite easy then, because you look at your husband, and even though he looked quite cute when he was young, he's not cute now. It's very easy to do a super meditation on a husband when he's over 40 or 50. Let alone your wife. It's very easy to see there, my goodness, why did I marry her? And that's an interesting question. Now why do people actually get married? Because this is my experience. I've been a monk a long time now, and some of my disciples, you know, you've looked after them when they're very young, and then they go and get married, and sometimes even monks. You know, in Thailand, it's not considered so much of a failure when a monk disrobes. In Sri Lanka, it's much harder to disrobe. But in Thailand, I think it's a bit too easy. So several of the monks I ordained as a preceptor, they have disrobed. And a year or two after they disrobe, they go and get married. And then I look at the girl they're married and say, what do you marry her for? She's ugly. She said, oh no, she's so beautiful, she's so wonderful and so lovely. And when that happened the first few times, I realized that what happens when you fall in love, anything looks beautiful. It's a distortion of perception, said the Buddha. And this is the problem. Because lust distorts perception, and even an ordinary looking girl looks incredibly beautiful. And even just a skinny guy looks so strong. Because of that, you realize that lust actually does distort perception. And it makes you see not what's there, but what you want to see, what you expect to see. And I already mentioned, I think, like before, 2 nights ago, that you know, people go romancing at night time. That's where you take out your girlfriend or your boyfriend, and that's where you fall in love. And because in the darkness, because you can't totally really see what your boyfriend looks like or what your girlfriend looks like, that's when perception is free to distort. So it makes your girlfriend look like some supermodel. I actually asked in, I think the guys would understand this, I asked in Malaysia last time, who is the most beautiful girl in the world? And it's some girl called Megan Fox, whoever she is. Do you know her? I don't know her. And who's the cutest guy? It's Justin Bieber or something. See, they know, the girls know, they're like. And so in the moonlight or in the sort of nightclub, it's so dark. Even your ordinary looking girl, you know, looks like Megan Fox, some supermodel. And the guy looks like Justin Bieber, just so wonderful. Ooh, so cute and so hot, you know, in the nightclub. And this is what happens. And that's even for monks and for nuns, that can be a danger, especially for young monks and young nuns. Because once we get lust coming up, we change our perception, and that ordinary looking girl who walks in to give you dana looks so beautiful. And any old monk say, what, her? Because you change perception. Because you can change perception like this, it's good for monks to use a supa so that you have the ability to see the ugliness in the beautiful. In meditation, you see the beautiful in the ugly. So you can work your perception, have some sort of way to manipulate it. To see the beautiful in the ugly is how we overcome ill will and anger. You may have some monk or some layperson who gives you such a hard time. So you see the good qualities in that person. You see the beautiful in the ugly. Which means, oh, they're a good person, but they just make some mistakes. And that way you don't get lost in ill will. In the same way, we also learn how to perceive the ugly and the beautiful, so we don't get into lust. Now, the standard way of doing that is actually to look at the parts of the body. There are 31 parts in the suttas, 32 parts in the commentaries. But, you know, I've done that so many times, and so many other monks have done that. And frankly, according to my experience of being a monk for a long time, that doesn't work very well. I've known many, many monks who've contemplated the 32 parts of the body about 3 or 4 years, left the monkhood and got married 1 year later. They've contemplated all these parts of the body so much that they start to own one. And they say, well, all these things are parts of the body. Yes, but the way they're put together is so luscious and lovely. That's the problem. So doing the 31 parts of the body, yeah, sometimes it can help. Which is why, we have all these funny stories, what we do as teaching young monks. When you are a young monk, the first thing you do, I'm sure this happens in Sri Lanka as well, the Samanera ordination, you give the 5 kamatanas, Kesa Loma Nakadanta Tasha. And of course, when I was given that as my novice ordination, many, many years ago, I wanted to find out why. What are you supposed to do with Kesa Loma Nakadanta Chacha? That's hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth and skin. It was only a long time afterwards I started to reflect on this and realize these are the 5 parts of the body which are on the outside. And all the other ones are inside, you can't really see them. And when you look at it, Kesa and Loma, hair of the head and hair of the body, what you see, you may see this beautiful blonde girl or dark-haired girl, whatever you like, see a beautiful hair. What are you seeing? It's all dead matter. Because as a scientist, I know the roots of the hair are actually under the skin. You can't see them. Or you see this really hunky guy with a nice beard and a nice moustache. That's all dead. Because the roots are underneath. And the same, if you notice, with the nails and the teeth, that's all dead. The roots are inside. Ask a dentist. This is dead matter. You hold a match to it, it doesn't hurt it at all. Because this is dead. And the nails, that's dead. The live part is just under the surface. And as for the skin, you know, you should know this from biologists, doctors here. The outside of the skin is still dead. It peels off. That's where you get the dust in the house. The live part of the skin is about a millimeter or two underneath. So actually, when you're seeing somebody, hair of the head, nails, teeth, skin, that's all dead stuff. Who would want to kiss dead stuff? Or even touch dead hair? That's really yucky, that's really weird. So I teach that. All the monks I see here, I all see dead stuff. All the bhikkhunis and the women out there, all I see is dead hair and dead skin and dead teeth. You're laughing, I see just dead stuff. Sounds good, doesn't it? But does it work? It may be dead hair, but it's just so beautiful. So it's a tough one. I'm just being honest with you. So sometimes that never worked, the 31 parts of the body. So I remember also I was very fortunate to, because I was a monk many years ago, it was really easy to go and see autopsies and see the body cut up. I don't know, can you see that in Sri Lanka? Oh, excellent. Because I remember some of the great autopsies which I would see in Thailand. Because you were monks, you were allowed just to walk into the autopsy rooms and no one would stop you. There were guards there to stop ordinary people, but monks, you could just walk straight in. And I remember arriving early to this autopsy room in Sirirat Hospital in the middle of Bangkok. And I couldn't believe it, because I was a Westerner, that the room was empty. You could see the bench there where they did the cutting up of the bodies. But they had high windows, and I saw on one of the window sills there was a plate with a human head on it. Now usually you have like flower pots, you know, with beautiful geraniums or roses or something. But here was a real human head on a plate. Now that, if that was in England, that would be so weird, you'd think you're in some sort of movie. But there it was, and of course later on they brought the body out and started cutting up. But you know, I was always interested in the body. To me it wasn't repugnant at all. I was really fascinated how it all fit together and just why this person died. Because I was, you know, scientifically minded, it wasn't repellent on. So it really didn't work for me. Yeah, you know, you see a heart, you see a lung, you see a liver or whatever. But it's just interesting with science. Just like in biology class when you dissections. I remember we asking the person who did the autopsies. He was like the coroner, they call it in English. And I say, you do these autopsies every day. Now what do you think when you see your wife back home? And he said, no, this is my job. When I see bodies, even women's bodies, it's just a body. When I see my wife, it's my wife. It doesn't really affect me. So there was a professional cutting up bodies every day, and he could still go home and have sex with his wife. It didn't work for him. So then I went to, there was a special autopsy room, this was 36 years ago in Thailand, where because Thailand was, Bangkok was on a river, on the weekend there'd always people be murdered and thrown in the river. And they'd be dragging them out of the river and bloated corpses. Just like you read, you know, in the text. A corpse bloated and blue for many days. And that's what I saw. There was one special room where they would do those autopsies. And so when you saw your first bloated corpse, the eyes were really bulging, the whole body was blown up. And it really looked scary. But what was worse was the smell. Because when the body's been rotted for a few days, the smell was disgusting. But I was a monk, so you went in and had a look. And when the doctor came in, I'm sure that the doctors who did the autopsies on bloated corpses must have done something wrong, and this was their punishment to do this particular autopsy. Because what they had, it was not refined equipment. They had like a long bamboo pole with a nail on the end. And what they did, it was a long pole because the doctor stood as far back as he could and he popped the body with the nail. Because of all the gas which was inside, which made it bloated, and this yucky stuff just spat up onto the ceiling. And the smell just, you know, I was a tough monk, I couldn't stand that. He reeled back. It was the most disgusting smell I've ever smelled in my life. And so that was good. That was interesting. But even so, you know, I looked at beautiful girls and they weren't bloated yet, so she would do. It didn't work again. So, you know, all the theories, you know, weren't really working. But then I looked, what does it mean, asupa? It means impure, not perfect. And it was when I understood the word asupa, what I did, and this one actually did work. As a young monk, if a beautiful young girl came into the monastery, I would look for her imperfection. I look for some pimple on her skin, or some smell under her armpits, or whatever it was. And you do the same with boys too. Because I remember as a young man, You know, you wanted to see your girlfriend as beautiful, as perfect. And what lasted, it would not see the faults in her. It would see her as, again, the supermodel. As a girl, you look at your boy's strong, perfect, you'd be in denial of all his faults. So all you needed to do was to find that first fault in that girl, the pimple, the defect. And that was all that was necessary to stop the lust. She wasn't perfect enough. She had a fault. It was like buying a car and there was a scratch on it. No, I won't take that one. I'll wait for another one to come in next week. So seeing the defects was what helped me with a super. Because once you saw the first defect, it was easy to see the second, the third, the fourth. And now she wasn't good enough. So that's for the you young bucks, there's quite a few here. If you really committed to the monastic life, then try that, the super, seeing the imperfections in that person. Or, you know, young ladies want to live the monastic life, see the imperfection in that guy. And then you don't want to buy. It's spoiled goods. And who wants to go to a shop and buy, say, a teapot with a crack in it? You don't want it. So that really helped me quite a lot with the supa, which meant that whenever I liked, I could control my lust. I could see someone else, sort of, I see she looks beautiful, but you get close, you see her pimples or some defect. No, she's not perfect enough. And so all that wanting disappeared. But it never got that far that I saw anybody as repulsive. Because I know that some monks have done that. They've got so far into a supa, they become almost crazy. They say, she stinks. He is just, should have a wash or whatever. It's just so repulsive. You go over the top, you get into negativity. And with too much of super, that negativity gives rise to anger. And you become such a negative, angry person. And it's impossible to meditate. You're just too tense, negative, and having too much suffering. So with the super, I always like to try the looking at imperfections. I know that once even I remember this story of just how some of these interesting methods which some people invent also don't work. Because I remember even Ajahn Chah, he was very, very good, very innovative. But even some of the things he suggested didn't work. I was in the car one day in the back seat with two other monks. Ajahn Chah was in the passenger seat and there was another layperson driving. We were going to the station. So there, Ajahn Chah in the passenger seat and three monks behind, and I was one of those monks. And sitting next to me was a young American who was only Samanera. But Ajahn Chah turned around in the middle of the journey, looked at him and said, Gary was what his name was. Gary, you're thinking of your girlfriend back in Los Angeles. And poor old Gary, his face went white, his jaw dropped, because Ajahn Chah could read minds, and he was reading minds. He was thinking of his girlfriend. He's not supposed to do that as a monk or a novice. So he was caught out. So be careful what you're thinking this evening. But then Ajahn Chah, he said to the translator, he said, never mind, I can help you. Said, next time you write to your girlfriend in Los Angeles, ask her to send something back to you, something personal. So when you miss her, you can look at that and think of your girlfriend. And I thought, that's actually traditional in the West. I'm not sure if you do that in Sri Lanka. If you go away and you have a picture of your girlfriend or your wife, or have a lock of her hair, a piece of her dress with her scent on it, just so that if you miss her, you can take out the piece of the dress and smell, oh, that's my beautiful wife. And I thought, I was a very young man. I never realized these forest ajahs were so romantic. Those of you who know the story know what's coming next. But then Ajahn Chah said to the interpreter, no. Don't ask for a lock of her hair or a piece of her scented dress. Ask her to send you a little bottle with her feces inside. You can't get more personal than your girlfriend or your wife's feces. And then whenever you miss your girlfriend, open up the top. That's my girlfriend back in Los Angeles. Because that's part of her. He disrobed a year later. It didn't work for him either. But it's a great story. Now, unfortunately, the lust can always find its way around these things. So the asupa meditations, yeah, they can be interesting. But in my experience, they haven't been strong enough. If you want to have lust, you will. But what worked for me is seeing the defect in something. And all I need to do is to get that first defect and that stop lust. Because what lust is, it sees what you want to see as beautiful. And it wants to do that, and it keeps doing that. It keeps looking at her hair, it keeps looking at her body, it keeps looking at the things which are perfect and beautiful. And as you go in lust, it's even more perfect and more beautiful. And the illusion grows until they become this amazing, beautiful girl. It's why that sometimes when you first look at a girl, you don't like her, but later on she grows on you. She doesn't grow on you, lust has grown on you. Or with a boy as well, so be careful there. Look at a defect, and then you get the balance. He's just a girl, that's all. He's just a boy, just an ordinary human being, and they're not perfect. This is not Devaloka. Maybe in Devaloka all the girls and boys are beautiful, but not in this Manusaloka. We're all imperfect. Just look at her fillings in her teeth, or whatever else it is which is imperfect. And then that's the end of lust. So that's a asupa with what's the most important for monastics, which is the opposite gender. There's also other things we have, we need to get a asupa, because many things we lust towards or we desire. Now, sometimes it's like robes. I don't know why people want fancy parikara or pirikira. Sometimes we see, wow, that's a really nice robe, and we want that. Even as a senior monk, actually, I've got some patches on my underrobes. Even as a senior monk, I always make sure I've got a patch somewhere on my robes. Even though you're a senior monk, and apparently after this, people are going to offer me more robes. But I usually give those away, because if I have a robe, I'm going to wear this, and when it gets torn, I'm going to put a patch on it, and another patch, and another patch. You know what happens with Mahakasapa? He had so many patches on his robe that people had lust for that. Oh, I want a robe like that too. It's really weird that you can desire for even ugly things as well. So that's what lust can do. So whether it's your pirikara, remember this is just for covering your body, just for looking after yourself. So it's not to do with having the perfect beautiful bowl or the perfect beautiful shoes or whatever else. It's just to be used. Who cares what it is? So please, monks, live simply. Patch your robes. Don't worry what colour your robes are, as long as it's the right colour according to the Vinaya. Don't worry about just the bowl or other stuff you have or your umbrella, what colour it is. Just practical simplicity. Otherwise, I've seen monks have that spiritual materialism for their requisites. Keep it simple. And if you have desire for requisites, for nice robes, they're the ones who should actually start to use simple robes or more patch robes and see the danger in these things. Or sometimes people want to be famous and be like a monk who goes on TV. Look, take it from myself, or Venerable Panyasiri, going on TV is a lot of suffering. I went on TV once in Australia that had to go on a news channel to get interviewed. And this was many years ago. And when I went into the studio, they said, you have to go to makeup. I said, I'm a monk, do I have to? Yes. And the worst thing, there was another monk with me. And as he was washing, this oil and powder put on my face, he was laughing and ridiculing me. It was so embarrassing. It was one of the most embarrassing times of my life as a monk. I was a male. Males don't like makeup, and monks even worse. So it's a lot of suffering. Do not be famous. But sometimes we want to be famous, we want to be popular. Look at the defects in that, and then all your lust and desire disappears. So whatever else you like, you want. Look for its defect, and that's asupa, and that means it will take away much of your craving. The way it takes away your craving, then you're free, you're at peace. To me, that's the job of asupa, to see imperfections, to cut the craving, but not to give rise to aversion, to ill will. So asupa should be a balancing. A lot of times you don't need to do asupa. You know, you're peaceful, you haven't got any craving. You know, we're not sort of, you know, in the middle of a sort of the town here, so people don't come in here with beautiful clothes, and there's not really much room for lust. So you don't really need to do asupa all the time. But it's there for you in case you get sort of attracted and get into lust. So it's always used with a balance, as an antidote. So you don't take the antidote for snake venom unless you've been bitten by a snake. So if you've been bitten by lust, then take the antidote of a super. Maybe you can train in the super just so you're used to taking the antidote, but you don't need to overdo it. So that's why I don't do much a super. And don't encourage too much. A little bit, but not too much. Now the other meditation, which is very common, and some people have mentioned, is kasina meditation. There's an alternative to the breath meditation. That's where you have a disc of light. I know there is like the other kasinas, like the, what is it, the fire kasina, water kasina, or things like that. But what you need to do there is be able to visualize. Literally, again, as I said the other day, to imagine. So, you know, you use the external object over there so you can imagine the object inside. Some people can do that very easily. Some people find it difficult to visualize. I know many Australian monks, they've ordained in the Tibetan tradition, and that's their main meditation. They have to visualize these very, very complicated images of green tara or mandalas. And you ask them, can they do it? They said, no, we can't. Can you please teach us breath meditation? So many of the Tibetan these Westerners who are trained in the Tibetan tradition, they ask to do Theravada Anapanasati because it's so difficult for them to visualize. But if you have a visual mind, fine, do that. And how it works is you've got to have an image inside your mind, first of all, but it's so difficult to hold unless it's delightful. So which is why if you are choosing a kasina, it has to be some object or some color which you like, which you have an affinity towards, which you like looking at. Because only if you like looking at it can you actually hold it. To visualize something, yes, you can visualize anything for a couple of seconds, but to behold it long enough to actually to work in meditation is a very difficult thing to do, unless it's delightful and beautiful. So some people have an affinity for certain colors, and so they can look at that color, and they can close their eyes, they can visualize it, and very quickly it becomes delightful. And it's important to get the delights in that image pretty quickly. It has to look beautiful. If it doesn't, you're going to have a hard struggle, a lot of effort keeping it in your mind. If it's delightful, you don't have to put forth effort. It's a delight holds the attention. It holds mindfulness. Remember, there's two ways of maintaining mindfulness. One is through effort, which is tiring and it makes you tense. The other way is through encouraging delight. And if it's something you're delighting in, where's the effort? You can focus on it with ease. You know, if there is the most beautiful girl in Sri Lanka comes in this room right now, you won't need to put effort to maintain your attention on her. It's natural. You have to put effort to turn your attention away. If it's something very beautiful, it's very easy. I remember actually a couple of times I've given retreats and supermodels have been on my retreat. The first time was in Perth. There was a Thai film actress came on my retreat. She was very famous in Thailand. No one knew her in Australia, but she was one of these great screen stars. So on that retreat, I was amazed how many young Thai boys came on my retreat to learn meditation. They weren't there for the meditation, they were there for the girl. I remember another one of my students in Perth. She went up to Dharamsala in India to visit the Dalai Lama. And so she went to the morning meditation and she couldn't watch her breath at all. Because sitting right next to her was Richard Gere. You know, he's a film star, an American film star. watching the breath, but mostly watching Richard Gere. So sometimes it's difficult. Sometimes you have to take your attention away and develop that super. But anyway, if it's something which is delightful, it's easy to watch. So if you've got a limiter, actually if you've got a kasina, the object has to become delightful pretty quickly. And when that delight comes, please don't push it away. Because it makes the meditation on kasina work. It means you can stay there. And because you can stay there, the mind becomes more still. Because it becomes more still, the delight gets bigger. Because the delight is bigger, it's easy to stay there, you get even more still, the delight gets bigger. That little object turns into the beautiful limiter. This is actually how the kasinas work. Exactly the same as, or pretty similar to the way we deal with the breath meditation. You have to get to the delightful breath. So when you're in the delightful breath, you don't have to put any effort anymore. It's just delightful. It's so easy to watch. Just like watching a supermodel. It's so delightful, so beautiful, so satisfying. Because it's delightful, you don't have to put forth any effort. Because you're no effort, you're not disturbing anything. You get more and more still. The breath becomes more beautiful, turns into nimitta, and off you go into the jhanas. So the delight is an important thing, even with the kasinas. You have to develop it. So that is where it's wrong to have a mind which is focused on too much of supa. Because supa always sees the faults in things. And if you've done too much of supa, you get to the breath, delightful breath, but it's not delightful enough. There's a fault in it. There's a defect in it. The kasina, there's a defect in it. That will stop you progressing. Monks who do too much of supa develop the fault-finding mind. And that's the problem. So do some, but not too much. And get the positive mind, which can see the beauty in things, because that will lead you into the deep meditations, the jhanas, which are necessary for enlightenment. Some of the other meditations which people do, we've mentioned Buddhanusati, and Dhammanusati, Sanghanusati, Siranusati, Devatanusati, Chaganusati. These are the inspirational meditations. And these are really important, because I use these a lot. Even though I've got a lot of skill on my breath meditation, which is my basic meditation, sometimes you're weak, you're tired, maybe you're working too hard, and sometimes it's not my fault. You know, sometimes people make me work hard when I go overseas. You know, I've just got no control over what I have to do. Sometimes you go for a rest and somebody asks you a question. So it's just my life. And so it does come to me many times that I have to perform to give a big public talk somewhere or answer someone's questions, and it's important for them, and I'm very tired and exhausted. So what do? I develop these inspirational meditations. Look, and I remember one time that in my group in Singapore, I was giving a talk as part of their annual celebrations. And it was actually two celebrations. And after the first one, I just arrived on the flight from Australia. I was very tired. I gave a talk, managed to do it. Afterwards, I was exhausted. There was another talk that evening. All my supporters went out for dinner. And they left me exhausted and tired. And I knew I had to give an inspiring talk in about half an hour, 45 minutes time. So what I did, I found a quiet place in the auditorium. There was a locked door with a passage leading to it. So because it was locked, I could sit right outside of it and no one would come through. Then I did all my inspirational meditations, reflecting on the Lord Buddha. And just what an incredible thing that was, that a Buddha arose in this world. Without that, we wouldn't be here. There would be no Dhamma. There would be no Sangha. What is actually Buddha did? You know, without any teachers, without any instructions, found this incredibly powerful, beautiful Dhamma by himself. That was amazing. It was such a rare, incredible thing. And I start talking to myself like this until I get so much energy coming through that sometimes you start to cry. You know, sometimes Buddha statues, you know, there's some Buddha statues in the world which are incredibly inspiring. And my favorite one, it's not the Samadhi statue, you know, here in Sri Lanka. It's the Dhammacakka statue, which is in the Indian Museum in Benares. know, just outside of Sarnath. You know, you see it on many, many front covers of many pictures, and if you haven't seen that in reality, go and see it. I knew it was in this museum the first time I went to Benares. And so after, you know, going around the Dhammachaka stupa and all the monuments in the deer park in Benares in Sarnath, then it said the museum's over there, you had to pay to get in, even as a monk. So the dayaka, the people taking me on pilgrimage, they paid for that. But in the museum in India, there was no guidebooks or guides. It's not like the museum, say, here in Sri Lanka or in the West. You get a guidebook and there's arrows pointing here and pointing there. It was just basically no one was around. So I had to try and find that statue for myself. And I looked here and looked there. And then, for those of you who know that museum, I went down a passageway and turned the corner. And there it was, at the end of the corridor, the Dhammachaka. Statue. It was so incredibly beautiful. I got so much pity coming up, tears came out. I couldn't help it. It was beautiful. So you know what I did? Just bow three times and yitipi so bhagawa. You couldn't help yourself. I didn't care who was there. I was going to do my chanting because you had to. Just so much pity sukha came out. And the second time I went, I was leading a group and I knew exactly where it was. This time, and of course I knew that I'd got sort of too much pity sukha, so I was going to restrain myself. So I was prepared this time. So when we turned the corner, pity sukha came up again, the tears rolled again, I couldn't help it. And I always remember the third time as well. The third time was the best. This time I knew, and I was prepared, if you want to have pity sukha and just have this incredible sort of beautiful energy, the tears, fine. As we turned the corner, there was a Dhammachaka statue, covered in a cloth. Come all this way, and all my expectations, you know, having a beautiful Buddha statue and having pity sukha were dashed. It was covered with a cloth because they were painting the ceiling. And I thought, oh no, that's what happens, Ajahn Brahm, when you have expectations. You always get disappointed. So I learnt my lesson. And without us saying anything, the painter stopped painting and took the cover off. He saw the statue again. And I allow myself to do that, and I remember those cases, those times, because that gives you such strong inspiration that you go and meditate and you've got that incredibly beautiful energy, inspiration in the Buddha and his qualities. And sometimes statues are so beautiful, so perfectly executed, they just give you that serene, blissful, peaceful compassion which the Buddha has. And that's, for me, the best. If you haven't seen it, please go and see it. It's perfect, like it was made by some deva somewhere. So that's my favourite Buddha statue. But sometimes, if that doesn't work, I reflect upon the Dhamma. It's incredible what the Buddha taught. You know, whether it's the Dhammachaka Sutta or the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, your favourite suttas, you reflect upon them and how powerful they have been. Those teachings have enlightened millions of people through the ages, in all lands, all genders. It's incredible the power of that Dhamma. When I start reflecting on what it's meant for me, and just incredible amounts of suffering it's taken away, lifetimes of suffering. You get so inspired. You let that inspiration come up. You not only allow it, you generate it, you encourage it, so it gets really, really strong. And then all my tiredness or negativity is totally gone. Then you meditate, you have a wonderful time. As I mentioned this morning about Ajahn Chah teaching the Dhamma. You know, sometimes people can teach the Dhamma, and it sometimes really hits you hard. It's just so beautiful. And maybe just one or two words, and then you see them, understand them, and you get so inspired. If that happens to you during any talk, my talk or anyone else's talk, close your eyes, stop listening, and get into jhana. Forget about the talk. That's what the purpose of the talk is, to inspire you, so you get lots of pity sukha, the defilements of God. Close your eyes and bliss out. That's what it's there for. So this is Dhamma Nusati. And even Sangha Nusati, the great teachers you've known, examples of people who've actually practiced this path. That's why I like reading a Theragata, and a Terikata, the poems of ordinary people who became arahants. And these were people who were far less educated than you are. People who had far less parami or spiritual qualities than you have. You're very fortunate. You've been born in a land like Sri Lanka, a healthy body, great education, well fed, looked after. You've got so many parameters, spiritual qualities. And these were people who had hardly anything. Prostitutes, Badali the dwarf, the hunchbacks. And these people became enlightened. Wow, that's amazing. That really inspires you. Your back straightens up. Sloth and torpor, I don't know where that's gone. It's gone a million miles away. And then you've got energy, inspiration. It's important to gather that inspiration. That's what things like Buddha Anusati, Dhamma Anusati, Sangha Anusati are there for. But one of the ones I really get off on is Chaga Anusati. Because, you know, I do a lot of giving. I really sort of do a lot of serving. You can see just how I work. And you don't think that, oh, in a couple of days you go back to Persing and take a rest. Ha ha ha. I keep on working when I get there. You know, Venerable Panyasiri knows this. He works so hard. All the translations he's been doing here. There's an incredible amount of work you've been doing. You're so fortunate to be able to work so hard for the Dhamma. Because when you do things like that, and you reflect on it afterwards, how much you've sacrificed and given, you get this incredible energy coming up. And that's what I often use if I'm exhausted. You know, you're really tired, you've got to go on the TV in 10 minutes. Gee, what am I going to do? What am I going to say? Forget about that. What have I been doing today? How much Dhamma have I taught? How many people have I inspired? What have I actually served? The gift of Dhamma is the greatest gift. Dhamma Dana is the highest. That's what I've just done. Ooh! And I get all this energy surging in me, and all the tiredness disappears. The Buddha said it's one of those sequences in Anguttara Nikaya. And if you can practice Dhamma Veda and Atta Veda, Dhamma Veda is inspiration on the Dhamma, inspiration on the meaning. It gives rise to piti, this beautiful joy. And the piti gives rise to pasadi, especially the tranquility of the body. You can sit very still, all the aches and pains in the body vanish. And that gives rise to sukha, this beautiful bliss, a peaceful mind. And that gives rise to samadhi, to stillness. These are the sequences which you see again and again and again in the suttas. From inspiration you get piti, from piti prasadi, tranquility, prasadi sukha. Sukha, sukhino jitang samadhiyati. From happiness the mind becomes still. I haven't mentioned that enough, that particular phrase. When I first read that, that again hit me hard. From happiness you get samadhi. Not from pain. Now you understand why I try to teach a happy path into samadhi. Get joy, get happiness, get inspiration. Because the Buddha said, Sukhino Chittang Samadhiyati, the happy mind becomes still, not the unhappy mind. So when you develop that happiness, you get stillness, you get chanas. And again, you know the rest of the sequence. From samadhi, you see things as they truly are, and then you get the enlightenment, and vimutti eventually, and then vimutti jhana, the knowledge of enlightenment. So this is the path. So by developing the inspirations, which, you know, you can do by Buddha Anusati, Dhamma Anusati, Sangha Anusati, and Chaga Anusati, and also Sira Anusati,